Chapter 7. Fresh fruit for the invalids, to be sure, and enormous meals for those who had time to eat them. But apart from the omnipresent smell and a little arrack that came aboard by stealth, the wonders of the East, the marble palaces, remained distant, half-guessed objects for the surprise. She was taken straight into the naval yard, and there they stripped her to the bone. They took out her guns and cleared her holds to come to her bottom, and what they found there made the master attendant clear the dry dock as fast as ever he could to bring her in before she sank at her moorings. The admiral visited her in state. He was a jolly rose-pink admiral, and he said the kindest things about the surprise, but he instantly deprived Jack of his first lieutenant, appointing Mr. Hervey to an 18-gun sloop as master and commander, thereby throwing all the labour of refitting onto the captain's shoulders. The admiral had a conscience, however, and he knew that Mr. Stanhope was of some importance. He spoke the good word to the master attendant, and all the resources of a well-equipped yard lay open to the surprise. The daughter of the horse-leech was moderation made flesh, compared to Captain Aubrey let loose in a Tom Tiddler's ground, strewn with pitch, hemp, tow, cordage, sailcloth by the acre, copper in gleaming sheets, spars, blocks, boats, and natural-grown knees. And although he too was afire to wander on the coral strand beneath the coconut palms, he said, "While this lasts, not a man shall leave the ship. Gather ye rose pods while ye may, as dear Christy Palliere used to say."
"May you not find the men grow wilful and discontented? May they not, with a united mind, rush violently from the ship?"
"They will not be pleased. But they know we must catch the monsoon with a well-found ship, and they know they are in the navy. They have chosen their cake and must lie on it."
"You mean they cannot have their bed and eat it?"
"No. No, it is not quite that, neither. I mean, I wish you would not confuse my mind, Stephen. I mean, it is only a week or so to snap up everything that can be moved before a Thalian or Revenge come in, screeching for spars and cables. Then I dare say we can take it easier, with native caulkers from the yard and some liberty for our people. But there is a vast deal of work to be done. You saw her spirketing. Weeks and weeks of work, and we must hurry."
From his earliest acquaintance with the Navy, Stephen had been oppressed by this sense of hurry. Hurry to look over the next horizon, hurry to reach a certain port, hurry to get away from it in case something should be happening in a distant strait, and hurry now not only to gather rose pods, but to catch the monsoon. If they did not set the envoy down in Kampong by a given date, Jack would be obliged to beat all the way back against headwinds, losing months of valuable time, time that might be spent in active warfare.
"Why," cried he, "the war might be over before we round the Cape if we miss the northeast monsoon. A pretty state of affairs."
And in the immediate future, there was this matchless opportunity for making the dear surprise what she had been, and what she ought to be again. Stephen cared for none of these things. The fire that vainly urged Jack to go ashore burnt with a devouring, an irresistible force in him. He left Jack, caressing a massive bulk of timber, the finest teak in the island. He said, "My patients are in the hospital. Mr. Stanhope is recovering with the governor. There is no place for me here. I must devote a certain amount of time to the shore. A variety of reasons require my presence on the shore."
"I dare say you must," said Jack absently. "Mr. Babington! Mr. Babington! Where is that infernal slow belly of a carpenter? I dare say you must. But however busy you are, do not miss the getting out of our lower masts. We go alongside the sheer hulk, and they lift them out like kiss my hand. It is the prettiest thing in the world. I shall send word the day before. You would be very sorry to miss the sheer hulk."
Stephen came aboard from time to time, once with a mathematical Parsee who wished to see the frigate's navigation tables, once with a child of unknown race who had found him lost among the blue buffaloes of the Ongya Maidan, in danger of being trampled, and who had led him back by the hand, talking all the way in an Urdu adapted to the meanest understanding, and once with a Chinese master mariner, a Christian from Macau, a spoilt priest with whom he conversed in Latin, showing him the working of the patent chain pump. And now and then he appeared at Jack's lodgings, where in theory he too had his bed and board. Jack was too discreet to ask him where he slept when they did not meet, and too well-bred to comment on the fact that sometimes he walked about in a towel, sometimes in European dress, and sometimes in a loose shirt hanging over white pantaloons, but always with an expression of tireless secret delight. As for sleeping, he lay where he chose, under trees, on verandas, in a caravanserai, on temple steps, in the dust among rows of other dust sleepers wrapped, as it were, in shrouds, wherever extreme bodily fatigue laid him down. Nowhere in the crowded city, accustomed to 100 races and innumerable tongues, did he excite the least comment as he wandered through the bazaars, the Arab horse lines, among the toddy groves, in and out of temples, pagodas, churches, mosques, along the strand, among the Hindu funeral pyres, through and through the city, gazing at the Marathas, Bengalis, Rajputs, Persians, Sikhs, Malays, Siamese, Javans, Filipinos, Kyrgyz, Ethiopians, Parsis, Baghdad Jews, Sinhalese, Tibetans. They gazed back at him when they were not otherwise employed, but with no particular curiosity, no undue attention, certainly with no kind of animosity. Sometimes his startling pale eyes, even more colourless now against his dusky skin, called for a second wandering glance, and sometimes he was taken for a holy man. Oil was poured on him more than once, and tepid cakes of a sweet vegetable substance were pressed into his hand with smiles. Fruit, a bowl of yellow rice, and he was offered buttered tea, fresh toddy, the juice of sugarcane. Before the partners of the mainmast were renewed, he came home with a wreath of marigolds round his bare, dusty shoulders, an offering from a company of whores. He hung the wreath on the right-hand knob of his blackwood chair and sat down to his journal. I had expected wonders from Bombay, but my heated expectations, founded upon the Arabian Nights, a glimpse of the Moorish towns in Africa, and books of travel, were poor, thin, insubstantial things compared with the reality. There is here a striving, avid, and worldly civilization, of course. These huge and eager markets, this incessant buying and selling, make that self-evident. But I had no conception of the ubiquitous sense of the holy, no notion of how another world can permeate the secular. Filth, stench, disease, gross superstition, as our people say, extreme poverty, promiscuous, universal defecation, do not affect it, nor do they affect my sense of the humanity with which I am surrounded. What an agreeable city it is, where a man may walk naked in the heat if it pleases him. I was speaking today with an unclothed Hindu religious, a Paramahamsa, on the steps of a Portuguese church, a true gymnosophist, and I remarked that in such a climate wisdom and clothing might bear an inverse proportion to one another. But measuring my garment with his hand, he observed that there was not one single wisdom. Never have I so blessed this facility for coming by a superficial knowledge of a language. My Fort William grammar, my trifle of Arabic, and above all my intercourse with Ahmet and Batu bear such fruit. Had I been dumb, I might almost as well have been blind also. What is the sight of a violin, and the violin lying mute? This dear child Dill teaches me a great deal, talking indefatigably, a steady flow of comment and narrative, with incessant repetition where I do not understand. She insists on being understood, and no evasion deceives her, though I do not believe Urdu is her mother tongue. She and the crone with whom she lives converse in quite a different language, not a familiar word. The ancient gentlewoman, offering me the child for 12 rupees, assured me she was a virgin, and wished to show me the fibula that guaranteed her state. It would have been quite superfluous. What could be more virginal than this tubular, fearless creature that looks me directly in the face as though I were a not very intelligent, tame animal, and that communicates her thoughts, views, the moment they are born, as though I, too, were a child? She can throw a stone, leap, climb like a boy, and yet she is no garçon manqué neither, for in addition to this overflowing communicative affection, she also has a kind of motherliness, and wishes to rule my movements and my diet for my own good. Disapproves my smoking bhang, eating opium, wearing trousers of more than a given length. Choleric, however. On Friday she beat a doe-eyed boy who wished to join himself to us in the palm grove, threatening his companions with a brick bat and with oaths that made them stare. She eats voraciously, but how often in the week? She owns one piece of cotton cloth that she wears, sometimes as a kilt, sometimes as a shawl, an oiled black stone that she worships perfunctorily, and her fibula. When fed, she is, I believe, perfectly happy, longing only, but with no real hope, for a silver bangle. Almost all the children here are encumbered with them and clank as they go. How old is she? 9? 10? The monarchy is not far off. A hint of a bosom, poor child. I am tempted to purchase her. Above all, I should wish to preserve her in this present state, not sexless, but unaware of her sex, free of her person and of all the gutters and bazaars of Bombay, wholly and immediately human. Wise, too. But only Joshua could halt the sun. In a year's time or less, she will be in a brothel. Would a European house be better? A servant, washed and confined? Could I keep her as a pet? For how long? Endow her? It is hard to think of her lively young spirit sinking, vanishing in the common lot. I shall advise with Diana. I have a groping notion of some unidentified common quality. This city has immense piety, but old Adam walks about. Bodies I have seen, some starved to death, some clubbed, stabbed, or strangled. And in any mercantile city, one man's evil is another's good. Yet a materialism that would excite no comment in Dublin or Barcelona shocks the stranger in Bombay. I was sitting under the Towers of Silence on Malabar Hill, watching the vultures. Such a view. I had taken Jack's glass, but I did not need it. They were so very tame. Even the yellow-billed Pharaoh's hen, which, Mr. Norton tells me, is most uncommon west of Hyderabad, and collecting some anomalous bones when Cowers G. Undertaker spoke to me, a Parsee in a plum-coloured hat. Having come from Mr. Stanhope, I was in European clothes, and he addressed me in English. Did not I know it was forbidden to take up bones? I replied that I was ignorant of the customs of his country, but that I understood the bodies of the dead were exposed upon these towers to be devoured, or taken away piecemeal by vultures, that the bodies thus become bonus nullius, that if property in the flesh could be conceived, then it was vested in the vulture, and that the vulture, relinquishing its title, surely in natural justice gave me a right to this femur, this curiously distorted hyoid, but that I was unwilling to offend any man's opinions, and that I should content myself with contemplating the remains rather than taking them away. My interest was not that of a ghoul, still less that of a glue merchant, but of a natural philosopher. He too was a philosopher, he said. The philosophy of number. Should I like to hear him extract a cube root? I might name any figure I pleased. A surprising performance. The answers came as quick as my piece of rib could write them in the dust. He was enchanted, and he would have gone on for ever if I had not mentioned Napier's bones, Gunter's scales, the applied mathematics of navigation, lunars, the necessary tables. Here I ventured out of my depth, was unable to satisfy him as to their nature, and therefore proposed carrying him to the ship. His curiosity overcame his evident alarm. He was gratified by the attention, pleased with the instrument, and on returning to land he invited me to drink tea at his counting-house. He is a considerable merchant. Here, at my request, he gave me a succinct account of his life, and I was disappointed, but not surprised, to find him a complacent, pragmatical, worldly fellow. Little do I know of the mathematics or the law, but the few mathematicians and lawyers I have met seem to me to partake of this sterility in direct proportion to their eminence. It may be that they are satisfied with an insufficient, or in the case of lawyers, almost wholly factitious order. However that may be, this man appears to have turned his benevolent ancient creed into an arid system of mechanical observances. So many hours devoted to stated ceremonies, so much of acknowledged income set aside for alms, no question of charity here, I believe, and a rancorous hatred for the Kadmis, who disagree with his sect, the Shen Shahis, not on any point of doctrine, but over the dating of their era. I might have been in Seething Lane. I do not imagine he is a typical Parsi, however, in anything but his alert, painstaking attention to business. Among other things, he is an insurer, a maritime insurer, and he spoke of the rise in premiums, plotting them against the movements, or the rumoured movements, of Linois' squadron, an armament that fills not only the company with alarm, but also all the country ships. Premiums are now higher than they were in Suffren's time. His family has innumerable commercial interests. Tibetan borax, Ben Kulin nutmeg, Tuticorin pearls my memory retains. My cousin's banking house is closely connected with the office of the commissioners for the former French settlements. He could have told me a great deal about them if it had not been for his sense of caution. Even so, he spoke with some freedom of Richard Canning, for whom he expressed respect and esteem. He told me little I did not already know, but he did confirm that their return is set for the 17th. He could tell me nothing about the Hindu ceremony on the shores of the bay this coming moon, neither cared nor knew. For this I must turn once again to Dill, though indeed her notions of religion are so eclectic as to lead her into confusion. God will not be merciful to him who through vanity wears long trousers, she tells me, a Muslim teaching, and at the same time she takes it for an acknowledged truth that I am a werebear, a decayed werebear, out of a place, an inept rustic demon that has strayed into the city, and that I can certainly fly, if I choose, but with a blundering flight, neither efficient nor in the right direction, a belief she must have taken from the Tibetans. She is right in supposing that I need guidance, however. The 17th. If Jack is accurate in his calculations, and in these matters I have never known him fail, I should have 3 weeks before the ship is ready. I am impatient for their arrival now, although when we came in I more than half dreaded it. What a wonderful interlude this has been! A piece of my life lifted quite out—
"Why, there you are, Stephen!" cried Jack. "You are come home, I find!"
"That is true," said Stephen, with an affectionate look. He prized statements of this kind in Jack. "So are you, Joy, and earlier than usual. You look perturbed. Do you find the heat affects you? Take off some of these splendid garments."
"Why, no, not more than common," said Jack, unbuckling his sword, "though it is hellfire hot and close and damp. No, I looked it on the off chance. I had to dine with the Admiral, as you know, and there I heard something that made my blood run cold, and I thought I ought to tell you. Diana Villiers is here, and that man Canning. By God, I wish the ship were ready for sea. I could not stand the meeting. Ain't you amazed? Shocked?"
"No. No, truly I am not, and for my part I must tell you, Jack, I look forward to the meeting extremely. They are not, in fact, in Bombay, but they are expected on the 17th.
"You knew she was here?"
cried Jack. Stephen nodded.
"You are a close one, Stephen," said Jack, looking at him sideways.
Stephen shrugged. He said, "Yes, I suppose I am. I have to be, you know. That is why I am alive. And one's mind takes the bent, but I beg your pardon if I have not been as free and open with you as I should have been. This is delicate ground, however." There was a time when they were rivals, when Jack felt so strongly about Diana that this was very dangerous ground indeed. Jack had nearly wrecked his career because of her, and his chance of marrying Sophia. In retrospect, he resented it bitterly, just as he resented her unfaithfulness, although she owed him no fidelity. He hated her, in a way. He thought her dangerous, if not evil, and he dreaded an encounter, dreaded it for Stephen more than for himself.
"No, no, my dear fellow, not at all," he said, shaking Stephen by the hand. "No, I am sure you are right. In keeping your counsel, I mean."
After a pause, Stephen said, "And yet I am surprised you should not have heard of their presence. If not in England, then here. I have been regaled with accounts of their cohabitation at every dinner I have attended, every tea-drinking, almost every casual encounter with a European." He had indeed. The coming of Richard Canning and Diana Villiers had been a godsend to Bombay, bored as it was with the Gujarat famine and the endless talk of Maratha war. Canning had an important official position. He had great influence with the company, and he lived in splendour. He was an active, stirring man, ready and eager to take up any challenge, and he made it clear that he expected their ménage to be accepted. Several of the highly placed officials had known her father, and those with Indian concubines made no difficulty, nor did the bachelors. But the European wives were harder to persuade. A few had much room to cast stones, but hypocrisy has never failed the English middle class in any latitude, and they flung them in plenty with delighted, shocked abandon. Rocks, boulders, limited in size only by fear for their husband's advancement. Conciliating discretion had never been among Mrs. Villiers' qualities, and if subjects for malignant gossip had been wanting, she would have provided them by the elephant load. Canning spent much of his time in the French possessions and in Goa, and during his absence the good ladies kept telescopes trained on Diana's house. With extravagant lamentation, they mourned the death of Mr. James, of the 87th Foot, killed by Captain MacFarlane, the wounding of a member of council, and less important hostilities. These affairs were spoken of with religious horror, while the many other quarrels in that liverish, overfed, parboiled community, much given to murder by consent, were passed over as amiable weaknesses, the natural consequence of the heat. Mr. Canning was of a jealous disposition, and unsigned letters kept him informed of Diana's visitors, imaginary and real.
"Sir! Sir!" cried Babington on the veranda.
In his strong voice, Jack called out,
"Hello!"
The staircase trembled, the door burst open, and Babington's smile appeared in the gloom. It faded at the sight of his captain's harsh expression.
"What are you doing ashore, Babington?"
asked Jack.
"Two pairs of shrouds cut in the eyes, and you are ashore?"
"Why, sir, the governor's colipar brought the mail, and I thought you might choose to see it right away."
"Well,"
said Jack, the gloom lightening,
"there is something in what you say."
He grasped the bag and hurried into the next room, coming out a few moments later with a packet for Stephen and disappearing again.
"Well, sir," said Babington, "I must not keep you."
"You must not keep your strumpet, either," said Stephen, glancing out of the window.
"Oh, sir," cried Babington, "she's not a strumpet. She's a clergyman's daughter."
"Then why do you perpetually borrow important sums of money from the only person in the ship weak enough to lend them to you? 2 pagodas last week, 4 rupees 6 pice the week before."
"Oh, but she only lets her friends, her friend, help her with the rent. It is somewhat in arrears. I put up there, you know, when I can get ashore, which is precious rare. But it is true, you've been very good to me, sir."
"You do? You do? Well, let me tell you this, Mr. Babington. Such things can lead very far, and clergymen are not all they seem. You will remember what I told you about Gamata and the third generation? Many an example may you see in the bazaars. How should you like to see your grandson, bald, stunted, and gibbering, toothless and decrepit before the age of 12? I beg of you to take care. Any woman is a source of great potential danger to a sailorman."
"Oh, I will, sir, I will,"
cried Babington, who had been peering secretly through the slatted blind.
"But do you know, sir, it is the most ridiculous thing. I seem to have left the ship without any money in my pocket."
Stephen listened to him hurtling down the stairs, sighed, and turned to his letters. Sir Joseph was concerned almost entirely with beetles of one kind or another. He would be infinitely grateful if his dear Maturin, happening to stumble upon any of the bupestrids, would remember him. But an enigmatic postscript gave him the key to Mr. Waring's letter, which seemed to be about a stupid, quarrelsome, litigious set of common acquaintances, but which, in fact, gave him a view of the political situation. In Catalonia, British military intelligence was backing the wrong horse, as usual. In Lisbon, the embassy was having conversations with still another dubious representative of the resistance. There was danger of a schism in the movement, and they longed for his return. News from his private agent. Mrs. Canning was making preparations for a voyage to India to confront her husband. The Mocattas had found out that he was obliged to be in Calcutta before the next rains, and she was to travel in the Warren Hastings, bound for that uncomfortable port. Sophie had omitted to date 3 of her letters with anything more definite than the day of the week, and he opened them in the wrong order. His first impression was that of time entirely dislocated, Cecilia placidly expecting a baby. "How I look forward to being an aunt," without any apparent sacrifice of her maidenhead or adverse comment from her friends. Frances removed to the desolate shores of Loch Erne, and there shivering in the company of somebody called Lady F, and longing for the return of one Sir O. A second reading made the situation clearer. Both Sophie's younger sisters had married, Cecilia to a young militia officer, and Frances emulating her sister's triumph. "How she must have changed," said Stephen, "to this soldier's much older cousin, an Ulster landowner who represented County Antrim at Westminster, while Francis lived with his aged mother at Floodsville, drinking confusion to the Pope twice a day in elderberry wine." There was joy, even exultation, at her sister's happiness. Cecilia at least adored the marriage state. It was even more fun than she had expected, although they were only in lodgings at Gosport, and would have to stay there until Sir Oliver could be induced to do something for his cousin. And a detailed description of their weddings, conducted with great propriety and in splendid weather by Mr. Hinksey, their own dear vicar being from home. But they were not really happy letters. They were not the letters he would have liked to read. A third reading convinced him that Cecilia's marriage had been tolerably hasty, that Mrs. Williams had been obliged to yield on all fronts, the brisk young soldier having undermined her citadel, but that she had had her way with Sir Oliver Flood, a wealthy man, and a dreary. And this third reading confirmed his impression of despondency. Mrs. Williams's spirits had revived with the excitement of the marriages and her victory over Sir Oliver's attorney, but now her health was on the wane again, and she complained much of her loneliness. Now that she and Sophia were alone, she had reduced the number of her servants, had shut up the tower wing, and had given up entertaining. Almost their only visitor was Mr. Hinksey, who dropped in every other day or so, and who dined with them whenever he took Mr. Fellowes's duty. Now that there was nothing else to occupy her mind, she renewed her persecution of Sophia, volubly when she was well, in pale gasps when she was confined to her bed.
"And the strange thing is that although I hear his name so very often, Mr. Hinksey is a real comfort to me. He is a truly friendly man, and a good man, as I was sure he would be from your recommendation of him. He thinks so highly of dear, unworldly Dr. Maturin, and you would blush, I am sure, to hear us speaking about you, as we so often do. He never obtrudes his feelings or distresses me, and he is as kind as can be to my mamma, even when she is not quite discreet. He preaches exceedingly well, no enthusiasm or hard words, and no what I suppose you would call eloquence either, and it is a pleasure to hear him, even when he speaks of duty, which he does pretty often. And I must say he practices what he preaches. He is the most dutiful son. It makes me feel wretched and ashamed. His mother, Stephen did not care about old Mrs. Hinksey. She was a beautiful old lady, so kind and gentle, but perfectly deaf.
Humbug! The woman can hear quick enough if she chooses, said Stephen. All these unscrupulous advantages and white hair, too.
He skipped to the part that worried him most. Sophia found it very strange that Jack had not written.
Why, you fat-headed girl, cannot you see that a man of war must outfly the swiftest post?
She was sure that Jack would never, never do anything unkind on purpose, but the best of men were thoughtless and forgetful at times, particularly when they had a great deal to do, like the captain of a man of war, and there was the old saying about distance and salt water doing away with other feelings. Nothing was more natural than a man should grow tired of an ignorant country girl like Sophia, that even quite ardent feelings should wear out in a man who had so many other things to think of, and such high responsibilities. Above all, she did not wish to be a clog on Jack, either in his career, Lord St. Vincent was dead set against marriage, or in anything else. He might have friends in India, and she would be perfectly miserable if, because of her, he felt himself bound or in any way entangled.
"The catalyst in all this is the general," observed Stephen,
comparing the letter with earlier examples of Sophie's hand.
"It is wrote hasty and in some agitation of spirit. The spelling is even poorer than usual."
Sophie passed it off as a trifling incident, but her amusement was forced and unconvincing. General Aubrey, together with Jack's new stepmother, a jolly, vulgar young woman, until recently a dairymaid, and their little boy, had descended upon Mapes, fortunately at a time when Mrs. Williams was in Canterbury with Mrs. Hinksey. Sophie gave them the best dinner she could, with several bottles of wine, alas. General Aubrey belonged to another civilization, a civilization untouched by the Age of Enlightenment or the spread of the bourgeoisie, one that had passed away in the counties nearer London long before Sophie was born, and one to which her essentially urban, respectable, middle-class family had never belonged at any time. She had been brought up in a quiet, staid, manless house, and she did not know what to make of his gallantries, his praise of Jack's taste. Cecilia would have been more at home with him, nor of his observation that Jack was a sad dog, always had been. But she was not to mind it. Jack's mother never had. Sophia would not mind half a dozen love children, he was sure. General Aubrey was not a disreputable man. He was kind and well-bred in his camp and country way, but he was chuckle-headed and impulsive, and when he was nervous, Sophia had no idea that a man of nearly 70 could be shy, and in wine, he felt he had to be talking. His outré facetiousness, his broad, earthy pleasantries, shocked her extremely, and he seemed to her a coarse, licentious, rakish, unprincipled caricature of his son. Her only consolation was that the general and her mother had not come into contact, and that her mother had not seen the second Mrs. Aubrey. She remembered the general's loud, candid voice, so reminiscent of his son's, calling out from the end of the long table that Jack
had not a groat to bless himself with, never would have. All the Aubreys were unlucky with money. They had to be lucky in marriage.
She remembered the endless pause after dinner, with a little boy poking holes in the fire screen, the concentrated urgency with which she willed the general to have done with his bottle, to come in, drink his tea, and go away before her mother's return, now long overdue. She remembered how she and the laughing Mrs. Aubrey had supported him into the carriage, the interminable farewells, the general recalling some endless anecdote about a fox chase and losing himself in it while the child played havoc with the flower beds, shrieking like a barn owl. Then, 10 minutes later, while she was still shattered, her mother's return. The scene, the cries, tears, swooning, bed, extreme pallor, reproaches.
"Stephen? I say, Stephen, I ain't interrupting you, am I?"
said Jack, coming out of his room with a letter in his hand.
"Here's a damned thing. Here's Sophie writing me the damnedest rigmarole. I can't show it to you, some very private things in it, you understand me, but the drift of it is that if I choose to feel myself free, nothing would make her happier. Free to do what, in God's name? God damn and blast my eyes, we are engaged to be married, ain't we? If it were any other woman on earth, I should think there was some other man hanging about. What the devil could she mean by it? Do you make head or tail of it?"
"It may be that someone has fabricated. It may be that someone has told her that you have come to India to see Diana Villiers," said Stephen, hiding his face with shame as he spoke. This was a direct attempt at keeping them apart, for his own purposes, partly for his own purposes. It was wholly uncandid, of course, and he had never been uncandid with Jack before. It filled him with anger, but still he went on. "Or that you may see her here."
"Did she know Diana was in Bombay?" cried Jack.
"Sure, it was common knowledge in England."
"So Mother Williams knew?"
Stephen nodded.
"Ah, that is Sophie from clue to earring," cried Jack, with such a radiant smile. "Can you imagine a sweeter thing to say? And such modesty, do you see? As if anyone could look at Diana after... However," he said, recollecting himself and looking deprecatingly at Stephen, "I don't mean to say anything wrong or uncivil, but not a reproach, not an unkind word in the whole letter. Lord, Stephen, how I love that girl!"
His bright blue eyes clouded, ran over, and he wiped them with his sleeve.
"Never a hint of being ill-used, though I know damn well what kind of life that woman leads her, to say nothing of filling her mind with ugly tales. A shocking life. You know Cecilia and Frankie are gone off, married. That makes it even worse. Lord, how I shall press on with the refitting, even faster now. I long to get back into the Atlantic or the Med. These are not waters where a man could look for any distinction now, far less any wealth. If only we had picked up a single decent prize off the Isle of France, I should write to her to come out to Madeira, and be damned to... A few hundred will buy us a neat cottage. How we should love a neat cottage, Stephen. Potatoes, cabbages and things."
"Upon my word, I cannot tell why you do not write, prize or no prize. You have your pay for all love."
"Oh, that would not be right, you know. I'm nearly clear of debt, but there is still a couple of thousand to find. It would scarcely be honourable to pay it off with her fortune, and then only have 7 shillings a day to offer her."
"Do you pretend to teach me the difference between honourable and dishonourable conduct?"
"No, no, no, of course not. Pray don't fly out at me, Stephen. I have spoke awkward again. No, what I mean is, it would not be right for me, do you understand? I could not bear it to have Mrs. Williams call me a fortune hunter. It is different in Ireland, I know. Oh, damn it, I'm laid by the lee again. I do not mean you are a fortune hunter, but you see it differently in your country. Outre pays, outre merde. But in any case, she has sworn never to marry without her mother's consent. So that claps a stopper over all."
"Never in life, my dear. If Sophie comes to Madeira, Mrs. Williams will be bound either to give her consent or to face a delighted neighbourhood. She was obliged to the same course in the case of Cecilia, I believe."
"Would not that be rather Jesuitical, Stephen?"
said Jack, looking into his face.
"Not at all. Consent unreasonably withheld may justifiably be compelled. I am concerned with Sophie's happiness and yours, rather than with pandering to Mrs. Williams's sordid whims. You must write that letter, Jack, for you are to consider Sophie is the beauty of the world, whereas although you are tolerably well-looking in your honest tarpaulin way, you are rather old and likely to grow older, too fat and likely to grow even fatter, nay, obese."
Jack looked at his belly and shook his head.
"Horribly knocked about, earless, scarred. "Brother, you are no Adonis. Do not be wounded," he said, laying his hand on Aubrey's knee, "when I say you are no Adonis."
"I never thought I was," said Jack.
"Nor when I add that you are no fox, either. No flashing wit to counterbalance want of looks, wealth, grace, and youth."
"Sure, I never set up for a wit," said Jack. "Though I can bring out a good thing on occasion, given time."
"And Sophie, I say again, has real beauty. And there are Adonises, witty, moneyed Adonises, in England. Again, she has led a devil of a life. Two younger sisters have married. You are aware of the importance of marriage to a young woman? The status, the escape, the certified guarantee of not having failed, the virtual certainty of a genteel subsistence? You are a great way off, 10,000 miles and more. You may be knocked on the head from one moment to the next, and at no time is there more than a 2-inch plank between you and the grave. You are half the world away from her, and yet within half a mile of Diana. She knows little or nothing of the world, little or nothing of men, apart from what her mother tells her. Small good, you may be sure. Lastly, there is her high sense of duty. Now, although Sophie carries humanity to a high pitch of perfection, no young woman more, still she is human, and she is affected by human considerations. I do not say for a moment that she coldly weighs them up, but considerations, the pressures, are there, and they are very strong. You must certainly write your letter, Jack. Take pen and ink." Jack gazed at him for a while with a heavy, troubled countenance, then stood up, sighed, pulled in his belly, and said,
"I must go down to the yard. We are shipping the new capstan this evening. Thank you for what you have told me, Stephen."
It was Stephen who took pen and ink and sat down to his diary. "I must go down to the yard," said he. "We are stepping the new capstan this evening." Had there been powder smoke in the room, a tangible enemy at hand, there would have been none of this hesitation, no long stare. He would have known his mind, and he would have acted at once, with intelligent deliberation. But now he is at a stand. With that odious freedom I prattled on. In doing so I overcame my shame, but it was bitter cruel and sharp while it lasted. In the instant between his asking, could I make head or tail of it, and my reply, the devil said to me, "If Aubrey is really vexed with Miss Williams, he will turn to Diana Villiers again. You already have your work cut out with Mr. Canning." I fell at once. Yet already I have almost persuaded myself that my subsequent words were the same as those an honest man would have used. Myself, if this attachment had not existed. Liaison I cannot say, since liaison implies a mutual attraction, and I have no sort of evidence for this other than my oh-so-fallible intuition. I long for the 17th. Already I am beginning to murder time like an ardent boy. Such an ugly crime. The sea festival will perhaps knock 6 innocent hours on the head. The ceremony took place all along the shore of Back Bay, from Malabar Point to the fort, and the broad park-like stretch of grass before the fort was one of the best places for viewing the preparations. Like all Hindu ceremonies he had seen, this appeared to be going forward with great excitement, great good humour, and a total lack of organisation. There were some groups already on the strand, with their leaders standing waist-deep, wafting flowers into the sea. But most of the inhabitants of Bombay seemed to have gathered here on the green to mill about in their best clothes, laughing, singing, beating drums, eating sweetmeats and saucers of cooked food from tiny stalls, breaking off now and then to form a vague procession, chanting a shrill and powerful hymn. Great warmth, an infinite variety of smells and colours, the bray of conches, deep hooting trumpets, countless people, and winding in and out among the people, elephants with crowded castles on their backs, bullock carts, hundreds and hundreds of palanquins, horsemen, holy cows, European carriages. A warm hand slipped into his, and looking down, Stephen saw Dill smiling up at him. "Art very strangely clothed, Stephen," she said. "I almost took thee for a topiwala. I have a whole leaf of pondu. Come and eat it before it spills. Mind thy good bazaar shirt in the dung. It is far too long, thy shirt." She led him across the trampled grass to the rising glacis of the fort, and there, finding an empty place, they sat down. "Lean thy head forward," she said, unfolding the leaf and setting the turgid mess between them. "Nay, nay, forward, more forward. Dost not see thy shirt all slobbered? Oh, for shame. Where wast thou brought up? What mother bore thee? Forward!" Despairing of making him eat like a human being, she stood up, licked his shirt clean, and then, folding her brown, jointless legs under her, she squatted close in front of him. "Open thy mouth!" With an expert hand, she moulded the pondu into little balls and fed him. "Close thy mouth, Stephen. Swallow. Open. There, Maharaj, another. There, my garden of nightingales. Open. Close." The sweet, gritty, unctuous mass flowed into him, and all the time Dill's voice rose and fell. "Thou canst not eat much better than a bear. Swallow. Pause now and belch. Dost not know how to belch? Thus. I can belch whenever I choose. Belch twice. Ooh, look, look, the Maratha chiefs!" A splendid group of horsemen in crimson, with gold-embroidered turbans and saddle-cloths. "That is the Peshwa in the middle, and there the Bonsle Raja. Ha, ha, Mahadeo! Another ball and all is gone. Open. Thou hast 15 teeth above and one less below. There is a European carriage, filled with Franks. Pah! I can smell them from here, stronger than camels. They eat cow and pig. It is perfectly notorious. Thou hast no more skill in eating with thy fingers than a bear, or a Frank, poor Stephen. Art thou a Frank at times?" Her eyes were fixed upon him with alert, penetrating curiosity. But before he could reply, they had darted off to an approaching line of elephants, so covered with housings, paint, howdahs, and tinsel, that below nothing could be seen but their feet shuffling in the dust, and before nothing but their gilt, silver-banded tusks and questing trunks. "I shall sing thee the Mahwari hymn to Krishna," said Dil, and began in a nasal whine, slicing the air with her right hand as she sang. Another elephant crossed in front of them, a trim pole set up on the howdah, bearing a streamer that read Revenge as it floated on the breeze. Most of the ship's starboard maintopmen were there, clinging to one another in a tight mass, while their larboard colleagues ran behind, calling out that they had had their spellmates and fair was fair. A competing elephant from the Golaya, almost hidden by a mass of delighted seamen in shore-going rig, white Senate hats and ribbons. Mr. Smith, a sea officer of the small, trim, brisk, round-headed port wine kind, once shipmates with Stephen in the Lively and now second in the Goliath, rode by on a camel, with his legs folded negligently over the creature's neck, to the manner born. He cut nimbly between the elephant and the bank, with his face at Stephen's level some 15 feet away. The Goliaths roared out to Mr. Smith, waving bottles and cheering, and Smith waved back to them. His mouth could be seen, opening and closing, but no sound pierced through the din. Dill sang on, hypnotized by her unvarying chant and the flow of words. More and more Europeans appeared, now that the day was growing cooler. Carriages of every kind, a disreputable drove of midshipmen from the Revenge and the Goliath, mounted on little Arab horses, asses, and an astonished bullock. More and more Europeans, and incomparably more Hindus, for now the climax was coming near. The strand was almost covered with white-robed brown figures, and the sound of horns drowned the low thunder of the sea. Yet even so, the crowds on the green grew thicker still, and now the carriages advanced at a walk, when they advanced at all. Rising dust, heat, merriment, and above all this immense activity, the kites and vultures wheeled in the untroubled sky, effortless rings, higher and higher, the highest losing themselves at last, black specks that vanished in the blue. Dill sang on and on. Bringing his eyes down from the vultures and the glare, Stephen found himself looking directly into Diana's face. She was sitting in a barouche under the shade of two apricot-coloured umbrellas with three officers, leaning forward with lively interest to see what had stopped them. Immediately in front of the carriage, two bullock carts had locked their wheels together. The drivers stood there shouting at one another, while the bullocks leaned inwards together against the yoke, closing their eyes, and from behind the shutters the purdah ladies shrieked abuse, advice, and orders. With a dense procession filing by forever on the right-hand side, and the steep slope of the glacis on the left, it was clear that the barouche would have to wait until the bullocks were disentangled. She twisted round with a movement Stephen had forgotten, but that was as familiar as the beat of his heart. The servants perched behind with the umbrellas ducked and swerved to give her a better view, but there was no retreat through the crowd, and she sat back in her seat, saying something to the man opposite her that made him laugh, and the apricot shadow swept over them again. She was, if anything, better looking than when he had seen her last. She was a little too far from him, to be sure, but it seemed that the climate, her almost native climate, which turned so many Englishmen yellow, had been kind to her, bringing to her a glow that he had not seen in England. At all events, that remembered perfection of movement was there, nothing studied about that sinuous turn, nothing that loosened all his judgment so. "What is amiss with thee?" asked Dill, breaking off and looking up at him. "Nothing," said Stephen, staring still. "Art sick?" she cried, standing up and spreading her hands upon his heart. "No," said Stephen. He smiled at her and shook his head. He was quite composed. She squatted, still staring up, and Diana, looking quickly from side to side, made some mechanical, smiling reply to her neighbour's remark. Her eyes swept along the glasses, passed over Stephen, suddenly returned and paused. With a growing look of doubt, and then the most extreme astonishment, and all at once her face changed to frank delight. It flushed, turned pale. She opened the door and sprang to the ground, leaving astonishment behind her. She ran up the slope, and Stephen, rising, stepped over Dill and took her by her outstretched hands. "Stephen! Upon my soul and honour!" she cried. "Stephen, how glad I am to see you!" "I am glad to see you too, my dear," he said, grinning like a boy. "But in God's name, how come you to be here?" "By sea, by ship, the usual way." Brief explanations cut again and again by amazement. 10,000 miles. Health, looks, mutual civilities, unabashed staring, smiles. How very, very brown you are. "Your skin is fairer than I saw it last," he said. "Stephen," muttered Dill again. "Who is your sweet companion?" asked Diana. "Allow me to name Dill, my particular friend and guide." "Stephen, tell the woman to take her foot from off my khatta," said Dill, with a stony look. "Oh, daughter, I beg thou wilt forgive me," cried Diana, bending and brushing the dust off Dill's rag. "Oh, how sorry I am! If it is spoilt, thou shalt have a sari made of Gochland silk, with 2 gold threads." Dill looked at the trodden place. She said, "It will pass," and added, "Thou dost not smell like a Frank." Diana smiled and wafted her handkerchief at the child, spreading the scent of attar from oud. "Pray take it, Dil Gudaz," she said. "Take it, melter of hearts, and dream of Sivachi." Dil writhed her head away, the conflict between pleasure and displeasure plain on her averted face, but pleasure won, and she took the handkerchief with a supple, pretty bow, thanked the Begum Lala, and smelt it voluptuously. Behind them there was the sound of bullock carts tearing free. The sais stood hovering to say the way was clear, the press extremely great, and the horses in a muck sweat. "Stephen," she said, "I cannot stay. Come and see me. I must tell you where I live. Do you know Malabar Hill?" I know," said Stephen, meaning that he knew where she lived, knew her house well. But she paid no attention in the hurry of her thoughts, and went on, "No, you will certainly get lost." She turned to Dill. "Dost know the Jain temple beyond the Black Pagoda, the palace of Jaswant Rao, and then the Satara Tower?" A rapid, intricate series of directions. Dill's expression was reserved, slightly cynical, patronizing, knowing. It was clear that only politeness kept her from cutting them short, from crying with Stephen, "But I know, then through the garden! He will certainly be lost without a wise hand to guide him, so bring him tomorrow night, I pray, and thou shalt have 3 wishes. Certainly he needs guidance." The carriage door slammed. The sais heaved up the steps. From out of the rigidly assumed discretion, the 3 officers stole secret glances at the glacis. The barouche melted into the sea of moving forms. For a few moments, the apricot umbrellas could still be seen, and then they were gone. Stephen felt the weight of Dill's unwinking scrutiny. He scratched himself in silence and listened to the now violent pounding of his heart. "Ooh, ooh, ooh!" she cried at last, rising and placing her thin hands together like a temple dancer. "Oh, oh, I understand it now." She writhed and stamped and swayed, chanting, "Oh, Krishna, Krishna ji, oh, Stephen Bahadur Sivaji, oh, melter of hearts, ha, ha, ha." Her mirth overcame her dancing, and she fell to the ground. "Dost thou understand?" "Perhaps not quite as well as thou." "I shall explain, make clear. She is wooing thee.
She wishes to see thee by night. Oh, shameless! But why, when she has three husbands? Because she must have a fourth, like the Tibetans. They have four husbands, and the Frank women are very like Tibetans. Strange, strange ways. The three have not given her a child, so a fourth there must be. And she has chosen thee because thou art so unlike them. She was warned in a dream, no doubt, told where to find thee, so unlike the rest. Wholly unlike? Oh, yes, yes, they are fools. It is written on their foreheads. And they are rich, and thou art poor. They are young, and thou art ancient. They are handsome, red-faced men, and thou? Most holy men are hideous, though more or less innocent. Horns and trumpets! Hurry, come, hurry! We must run down to the sea!
Stephen walked into the silversmith's alley, a lane even narrower than most, with awnings spread against the fierce declining sun. The heat was filled with an incessant clicking, not unlike an insect stridulation. On either side of the alley the smiths worked at filigree, nose-rings, anklets, bracelets, stomachers, each in his open cupboard of a shop. Some had braziers with pipes to direct the flame, and the smell of charcoal drifted along the ground. He sat down to watch a boy polishing his work on a crazy wheel that splashed red liquid into the lane.
"I am extremely unwilling that Dill should accompany me," he reflected, "and myself dressed in European clothes."
The shadow of a Brahmin bull fell over him and the stall, making the brazier glow pink. It thrust its muzzle into his bosom, snuffled, and moved on.
"I get so sick of lies. I have been surrounded with them and with deception in one form or another for so long. Disguise and subterfuge, a dangerous trade. The taint must come through at last. There are some, and Diana is one, I believe, who have a separate truth of their own. Ordinary people, Sophie and myself, for example, are nothing without the ordinary truth, nothing at all. They die without it, without innocence and candour. Indeed, the very great majority kill themselves long, long before their time, live as children, grow pale as adolescents, show a flash of life in love, die in their 20s and join the poor things that creep angry and restless about the earth. Dill is alive. This boy is living."
For some time, the boy, a creature with huge eyes, had been smiling at him between bracelets. They were well acquainted before Stephen said,
"Boy, wilt thou tell me the cost of those bracelets?"
"Bandit," said the boy, his teeth flashing, "the truth is my mother and my father. I will not lie to thee. There are bracelets for every degree of wealth."
When he found Dill, she was playing a game so like the hopscotch of his youth that he felt the stirring of that ancient anxiety as the flat stone shuffled across the lines towards paradise. One of her companions hopped exulting to the goal itself, her anklets clashing as she went. But it was false, cried Dill. She had not hopped fair. A blind hyena could have seen her stagger and touch the ground. Glaring about with clenched fists to call heaven and earth to witness, she caught sight of Stephen and abandoned the match, calling out as she left them that they were daughters of whores. They would be barren all their lives.
"Shall we go now?"
she asked.
"Art so very eager, Stephen?"
She found the notion of Stephen as a bridegroom irresistibly comic.
"No," he said. "Oh, no, I know the way. I've been there many times. I have another service to beg of thee, to take this letter to the ship."
Her face clouded. She pushed out her lower lip. Her whole body expressed displeasure and negation.
"Thou art not afraid to take it in the dark?"
he asked, glancing at the sun, no more than its own breadth above the sea.
"Bah!" she cried, kicking the ground. "I want to go with thee. Besides, if I do not go with thee, where are my three wishes? There is no justice in this world."
It had never been difficult to make out the nature of Dill's wishes, whatever their number. From the first day of their friendship she had spoken of bracelets, silver bracelets. She had told him, objectively and at length, the size, weight, and quality of every kind in the presidency, as well as those current in the neighbouring province and kingdoms, and he had seen her kick more than one well-furnished clanking child from mere envy. They walked to a grove of coconut palms overlooking Elephanta Island.
"I have never yet seen the caves," he observed, and took a cloth parcel from his bosom.
As though she, too, had been warned in a dream, Dill stopped breathing and watched with motionless intensity.
"Here is the first wish," he said, taking out one bangle. "Here is the second.
taking out two. And here is the third, taking out three more. She reached forward a hesitant hand and touched them lightly. Her fearless and cheerful expression was now timid, very grave. She held one for a moment, put it solemnly down, looked at Stephen gazing at the island in the bay, put it silently on, and squatted there amazed, staring at her arm and the gleaming band of silver. Put on another, and another, and the rapture of possession seized her. She burst into wild laughter, slipped them all on, all off, all on in a different order, patting them, talking to them, giving them each a name. She leapt up and spun, jerking her thin arms to make the bracelets clink. Then suddenly she dropped in front of Stephen and worshipped him for a while, patting his feet. Earnest, loving thanks broken by exclamations. How had he known? Preternatural wisdom nothing to him, of course. Did he think them better this way round or that? Such a blaze of light! Might she have the cloth they were wrapped in? She took them off, comforting them, put them on again. How smoothly they slipped, and sat there, pressed against his knee, gazing at the silver on her arms. "Child," he said, "the sun has set. It is the dark of the moon, and we must go."
"Instantly," she cried. "Give me the chit, and I fly to the ship. Straight to the ship!
She ran skipping down the hill. He watched her until she vanished in the twilight, her gleaming arms held out like wings, and the letter grasped in her mouth. He had seen the house often enough from the outside, was familiar with its walls, windows, entrances, a retired house deep behind its courts and inner walled gardens. But he was surprised to find how large it was inside. A small palace, in fact. Not so large as the commissioner's residence, but very much finer, being made of white marble, cool and intricately fretted in the room where he stood, an octagonal room domed with a fountain in the middle of it. Under the dome, a gallery, screened with this same marble lace, a staircase curving down from the gallery to the place where Stephen stood, and on the fifth step above him, three small pots, a brass pan for gathering filth. On the sixth, a short brush made of finely divided toddy palm frond, and a longer brush, virtually a broom. A scorpion had hidden under the pan, but it did not judge the shelter adequate, and he was watching its uneasy movements among the pots. Moving between them, it balanced its claws and tail, rising on its legs with a certain grace. At the sound of voices, he looked up. Shapes could be seen flitting through the pierced gallery, and Diana, followed by another woman, appeared at the top of the stairs. Most women show at a disadvantage, viewed from below. Not Diana. She was dressed in light blue muslin trousers, tight at the ankle, and a sleeveless jacket above a deep, deep blue sash, remarkably tall and slim, the foreshortening effect quite overcome. She cried, "Maturin!" and ran down the stairs. She caught her right foot on the pan and her left on the handle of the larger brush. The impetus of her run carried her clear of the remaining implements, the remaining stairs, and Stephen caught her at the bottom. He held her lithe body in his arms, kissed her on both cheeks, and set her on her feet.
"Pray take notice of the scorpion, ma'am," he called to the elderly woman on the stairs. "He is beneath the little broom."
"Maturin!" cried Diana again. "I am still amazed to see you, utterly amazed. It is impossible you should be standing here, much more astonishing than sitting there in the crowd by the fort, like a dream. Lady Forbes, may I introduce Dr. Maturin? Dr. Maturin, Lady Forbes, who is so kind as to live with me."
She was a dumpy woman, dressed in a haphazard way with ornaments here and there, but she had taken great care over her large face, which was painted out of resemblance to humanity, and with her wig, whose curls stood in order low on her forehead. She recovered from her deep curtsy, saying,
"He is an odd-looking bugger. A streak of the tar brush, I dare say. God damn this leg, I shall never get up. How do you do, sir? So happy? Was you born in India, sir? I remember some Maturins on the Coromandel coast."
Diana clapped her hands. Servants flowed into the room, exclamations of deep and even tragic concern at her danger and at the mess, soft, deprecating murmurs, bows, anxiety, gentle, immovable obstinacy. At last an aged person was brought in, and he carried the pan away. The scorpion was removed in wooden tweezers. Two different servants gathered up what was left.
"Forgive me, Maturin,"
she said. "You cannot imagine what it is keeping house with so many different castes. One cannot touch this, another cannot touch that, and half of them are only copycats. Such stuff! Of course a Radha Vallabhi can touch a pot. However, let us try whether they can give us anything to wet our whistles with. Have you eaten yet, Maturin?"
"I have not," he said.
She clapped her hands again. A fresh company appeared, a score of different people, and while Diana was issuing her orders, there was more wrangling, exhortation, and laughter than he would have expected outside Ireland, he turned to Lady Forbes and said,
"It is remarkably cool here, ma'am."
"Wrangle, wrangle, wrangle," said Lady Forbes. "She has no idea of managing her servants. Never had when she was a girl. Yes, sir, it is sunk for the purpose, quite underground, you know. God's my life, I hope she calls for the champagne. I am fair parched. Will she think this young fellow worth it? Aye, there's the point. Canning is very near with his wine. But there is the inconvenience that it floods. I remember 2 foot of mud on the floor in Raghunath Rao's time, for it belonged to him then, you know. However, there was really no rain this monsoon, no rain at all, hardly. Presently there will be another famine in Gujarat, and the tedious creatures will be dying off in droves, and making one's morning ride so disagreeable."
The parts of her conversation that were intended for herself were uttered in a deeper tone, but there was no variation in the volume of sound.
"Villiers," he said, "pray what language were you speaking to them?"
"That was Bangabasa. They speak it in Bengal. I brought some of my father's people back when I was in Calcutta. But come, tell me all about your voyage. A good passage? What did you come in?"
"A frigate. The Surprise."
"Such a good name. You could have, do not beat me if I say knocked me down with a feather, when I saw you in that wicked old shirt on the glacis. Exactly what I should have expected you to wear in this climate. So much more sensible than broadcloth. Do you admire my trousers?"
"Extremely."
"Surprise. Well, you astonish me. Admiral Hervey did speak of a frigate with a nephew of his on board, but he said the Nemesis. Is Aubrey in command? Of course he must be, or you would not be here. Is he married yet? I saw the announcement in the Times, but no marriage yet."
"I believe it is to be any minute now."
"All my William's cousins will be married," she observed, with a slight check in her bubbling gaiety. "Here is the champagne at last. Lord, I could do with a glass. I hope you are as thirsty as I am, Maturin. Let us drink to his health and happiness."
"With all my heart."
"Tell me," said Diana, "has he grown up at all?"
"I do not think that you would see a greater maturity," said Stephen.
"As I grow older, so I coarsen," he thought, emptying his glass. A greybeard with a silver mace advanced towards Diana, bowed and thumped 3 times. Immediately low tables came hurrying in, and great silver trays with innumerable dishes, most of them very small.
"You will forgive me, my dear," said Lady Forbes, rising. "You know I never sup."
"Of course," said Diana, "and as you pass by, would you be very kind and see that everything is ready? Dr. Maturin will be staying in the lapis lazuli room."
They sat on the divan, with the tables grouped in front of them. She explained the dishes with great volubility and a fair amount of open greed.
"You will not mind eating in the Indian way. I love it."
She was in tearing high spirits, laughing and talking away at a splendid rate, as though she had been long deprived of company.
"How it becomes her to laugh," he reflected. "Dulce loquentum, dulce ridentum. Most women are solemn owls, but then few have such brilliant teeth."
He said, "How many teeth have you in your head now, Villiers?"
"Lord, I don't know. How many should I have? They're all there, in any event. Ha! He has given us bit pie chatter. How I loved it as a child, still do. Let me help you. Do you think Aubrey would like to dine here with his officers? I could ask the Admiral. He is a vicious man, but he can be vastly pleasant when he chooses. Fool of a wife, but then so many naval wives are impossible, and some of the dockyard people, just men.
I cannot answer for him, of course, but I do know he is much taken up with his ship. She is being heaved up and heaved down. Vital pieces are being sawed out of her bowels. She was much shattered south of the Cape. He has refused all invitations apart from the Admiral's dinner, and that was a holiday of obligation.
Oh, well, damn Aubrey! But I cannot tell you how glad I am to see you, Stephen. I have been so lonely, and you were in my mind as clear as a bell just before I saw you. You are no great shakes at eating in the Indian way, I see. Oh, my God, what have you done with your poor hands?"
"It is of no consequence," said Stephen, darting them out of sight. "They were injured. Caught in a machine, it is of no consequence. It will soon pass."
"I will feed you."
She sat cross-legged on a cushion in front of him,
dipping into a dozen bowls, dishes, plates, and feeding him with balls that exploded in a pink glow inside his stomach, others that cooled and dulcified his palate. He looked attentively at her firm round legs under the blue muslin, at the play of her loins as she leant from side to side or towards him.
"What was that thin child I saw you with?" she asked. "A Dakhtari, too pale for a Gond. She spoke poor Urdu."
"I never asked her, nor did she question me. Tell me, Villiers, what must I do? I wish to ensure that she will eat to her hunger every day. At present she begs or steals most of her food. I may buy her for 12 rupees, so the thing should be simple, but it is not. I do not wish to put her into a way of earning an honest living, plying her needle, for example. She has no needle, nor does she feel the need for one. Nor do I wish to entrust her to the good Portuguese sisters to be clothed and converted. Yet surely there must be some solution."
"I am sure there is," said Diana, "but I should have to know much more about her before I could say anything of the least real use, her caste and so on. You never believe the difficulties that can cause when you are thinking of a place for a child. She may be an untouchable, probably is. Send her whenever you have any message for me, and then I can find out. In the meantime, she must certainly come here if ever she is hungry. We shall find a way, I am sure. But you will be a great simpleton if you pay 12 rupees, Stephen. 3 is more the mark. Another piece,
if you please, and do not let us neglect the pale ale at your elbow."
Ales, sherbet, mangosteens. The sky itself turned pale while they talked of Indian pastry cooks, the frigate's voyage, her purpose and intent, Mr. Stanhope, sloths, the great men of Bombay. Her only references to Canning were oblique.
"On her good days, Lady Forbes can be an entertaining companion, and at all events she keeps me in countenance. I need it, you know."
And,
"I rode 60 miles the day before yesterday, and 60 the day before that, right over the Ghats. That was why I was here so much earlier than I had expected. There was some tedious business to be discussed with the Nizam, and suddenly I could not bear it any longer and came on alone, leaving the elephants and camels to follow. They should be here on the 17th.
"Many elephants and camels?"
"No, 30 elephants and maybe 100 of camels. Bullock carts, too, naturally. But even a small train takes an endless time to get moving. You run mad and start to scream."
"And do you indeed travel with 30 elephants?"
"This was only a small journey, to Hyderabad, no more. When we go right across, we take 100, and all the rest in proportion. It is like an army. Oh, Stephen, I wish you could have seen half the things I saw this last time. Leopards by the dozen, all kinds of birds and monkeys, a python that had eaten a deer, and a well-grown young tiger, not up to our Bengal standards, but a tolerable fine beast. Tell me, Stephen, what can I show you? This is my country, after all, and I should love to lead you about. I am my own mistress for the next few days."
"God bless you, my dear. I should like to see the caves of Elephanta, if you please, a bamboo forest, and a tiger."
"Elephanta, I can promise. We will make up a party at the end of the week and ask Mr. Stanhope. He is a charming man, prodigious gallant to me in London, and your parson friend. The bamboo forest, too. The tiger I will not swear to. I am sure the Peshwa will try to drive one for us in the Pune hills, but they have had rain there and with the jungle so thick. However, if we do miss of a tiger there, I can promise you 6 in Bengal, for when you have set the old gentleman down in Kampong, you must come back to Calcutta, I collect."
Perhaps it was a mistake to invite Mr. Stanhope. The day was intolerably hot and humid. All he wanted to do was to lie on his bed with a punkah sighing over him, at least moving the unbreathable air. But he thought it his duty to wait on Mrs. Villiers, and he particularly wished to see Dr. Maturin, who had unaccountably vanished these last days. So, overcoming his nausea and putting a little carmine on his yellow cheeks, he embarked on the heavy, oily swell, and there being no hint of a breeze, they rowed him the 6 evil miles across the bay. Mr. Atkins sat by him, and in a rapid, excited whisper he told His Excellency of the discoveries he had made. Mr. Atkins was never long in any community before he mastered all the gossip. He had found out, he said, that this Mrs. V. was not a respectable person, that she was, in fact, the mistress of a Jew merchant.
"A Jew, for God's sake!"
And that her impudent presence in Bombay aroused indignation. That Dr. Maturin was aware of the couple's criminal conversation, and that he had therefore betrayed Mr. Stanhope into a false position, His Majesty's representative giving countenance to a connection of this sort. Mr. Stanhope said little in reply. but when he landed he was stiffer and more reserved than usual. In spite of his elaborate courtesy to Diana, his praise for the magnificent array of tents, umbrellas, carpets, cooling drinks, which reminded him of Ascot, for the lumpish statue of the elephant and the astonishing wealth of sculpture in the caves, his want of cordial enjoyment affected the whole company. He called Stephen aside as they were walking to the caves and said,
"I am very much disturbed in my mind, Dr. Maturin. I have word from Captain Aubrey that we are to embark on the 17th. I had counted upon at least another 3 weeks. Dr. Clowes's course of bleeding and slime baths lasts another 3 weeks."
"This must be some extravagant wild flight of naval hyperbole. How often do we not read of passengers urged to appear on board at, let us say, Greenwich or the Downs on a given date, only to find that the mariners have not the least intention of sailing, either for want of inclination or even for the want of the very sails themselves? You may set your mind at rest, sir. To my certain knowledge, the Surprise was without her masts only a very short time ago. It is materially impossible she should sail on the 17th. I wonder at his precipitancy."
"Have you seen Captain Aubrey recently?"
"I have not, nor to my shame have I called upon Dr. Clowes since Friday. Have you found benefit from his slime?"
"Dr. Clowes and his colleagues are excellent physicians, I am sure, and they are most attentive, but they do not seem to have prevailed with the liver complaint. They are afraid it may fly to the stomach and fix itself there. However, my main purpose in begging for these few moments was to tell you that we have received overland dispatches on which I should value your advice, and may I at the same time hint that perhaps you have not been quite as assiduous in attending at the office as ideal perfection might require? We have been unable to find you these last days in spite of repeated applications to the ship and to your lodgings in the town. No doubt your birds have drawn you away, have seduced you from your usual exact punctuality."
"I beg pardon, Your Excellency. I shall attend this afternoon, and at the same time we can discuss your liver with Dr. Clowes."
"I should be most infinitely obliged, Dr. Maturin. But we are neglecting our duty in the most disgraceful manner. Dear Mrs. Villiers," he cried, casting a haggard eye upon the feast spread in front of the caves, "this is princely, princely. Lucullus dines with Lucullus, upon my word."
Mr. White, the chaplain, to whom Atkins had at once communicated his discoveries, was as reserved as his patron. He was also deeply shocked by some of the female and hermaphrodite sculptures, and an unidentified creature had bitten him on the left buttock when he sat upon it. He remained heavy and stolid throughout the entertainment. Mr. Atkins and the young men of the envoy's suite were less affected by the atmosphere, however, and they made enough noise to give the impression of a party that was enjoying itself. Atkins, more than any, he was easy and familiar. He talked loudly, without restraint, and during the picnic he called out to Stephen,
"Not to let the bottle stand by him! It was not every day they could swill champagne!"
After it he led Diana to a particularly striking group at the back of the second cave, and holding up a lamp he desired her to take notice of the flowing curves, the delicious harmony, the balance, worthy of the well-known Greek sculptor Phidias. She was astonished at his assurance, the way in which he held her elbow and breathed on her. But supposing that he was in wine, she did not formalize upon it, only detached herself, regretted that she had been so simple as to follow him, and rejoiced at the sight of Stephen hurrying towards them. Mr. Atkins continued in high spirits, however, and when the party broke up on the Bombay shore he thrust his head into her palanquin and said,
"I shall come up and see you one of these evenings,"
adding with an arch look that left her speechless,
"I know where you live."
Later that day Stephen returned to the house on Malabar Hill and said to Diana,
"Mr. Stanhope desires his best compliments to Mrs. Villiers, and his heartfelt thanks for an unforgettably delightful afternoon. Lady Forbes, your servant. Do not you find it uncommon hot, ma'am?"
Lady Forbes gave him a vague, frightened smile, and presently she left the room.
"Maturin, did you ever know such a wretched, miserable, damned picnic in your life?" said Diana.
She was wearing an ugly, hard blue dress, tediously embroidered with pearls, and a rope of very much larger pearls in a loop to her middle.
"But it was kind of him to send his compliments, his best compliments, to a fallen woman."
"What stuff you talk, Villiers," he said.
I have fallen pretty low for an odious little reptile like that Perkins to take such liberties. Christ, Maturin, this is a vile life. I never go out without the danger of an affront, and I am alone, cooped up in this foul place all the time. There are only half a dozen women who receive me willingly, and four of them are demi-reps, and the others charitable fools. Such company I keep. And the other women I meet, particularly those I knew in India before, oh, how they know how to place their darts! Nothing obvious, because I can hit back, and Canning could break their husbands, but sharp enough and poisonous, my God. You have no notion what bitches women are. It makes me so furious I cannot sleep. I get ill. I am bilious with rage, and I look 40. In 6 months I shall not be fit to be seen.
Sure, my dear, you deceive yourself. The first moment I saw you, I remarked that your complexion was even finer than it was in England. This impression was confirmed when I came here and examined it at leisure.
I wonder that you should be so easily taken in. It is only so much tranquillon, as Amélie calls it. She is the best woman painter since what's-her-name?
Vigée Lebrun?
No, Jezebel. Look here, she cried, drawing a finger down her cheek and showing a faint smear of pink.
Stephen looked at it closely. He shook his head.
No, that is not the essence at all.
Though in passing I must warn you against the use of ceruse. It may desiccate and wrinkle the deeper layers. Hog's lard is more to the point. No, the essence is your spirit, courage, intelligence, and gaiety. They are unaffected, and it is they that form your face. You are responsible for your face.
But how long do you think any woman's spirit can last in this kind of life? They dare not use me so badly when Canning is here, but he is so often away, going to Mahay and so on. And then, when he is here, there are these perpetual scenes, often to the point of a break. And if we break, can you imagine my future? Penniless in Bombay? It is unthinkable. And to feel bound by cowardice is unthinkable, too. Oh, he is a kind keeper. I do not say he is not. But he is so hellish jealous. Get out! She shouted at a servant in the doorway. Get out!
Again he lingered, making deprecatory gestures, and she shied a decanter at his head.
"It is so humiliating to be suspected," she said. "I know half the servants are set to watch. If I did not stand up for myself, there would be a troop of black eunuchs, great flabby things, in no time at all. That is why I have my own people. Oh, I get so tired of these scenes. Travelling is the only thing that is even half bearable, going somewhere else. It is an impossible situation for a woman with any spirit. Do you remember what I told you, oh, a great while ago, about married men being the enemy? Here I am, delivered up to the enemy, bound hand and foot. Of course it is my own fault, you do not have to tell me of it, but that does not make the life any less wretched. Living large is very well, and certainly I love a rope of pearls as much as any woman, but give me even a grisly, damp, cold English cottage."
"I am sorry," said he, in a harsh, formal voice, "that you should not be happy. But at least it does give me some slightly greater confidence, a perceptibly greater justification in making my proposal."
"Are you going to take me into keeping too, Stephen?"
she asked, with a smile.
"No,"
he said, endeavouring to imitate her. He privately crossed his bosom, and then, speaking somewhat at random in his agitation, he went on, "I have never made a woman an offer of marriage. Am ignorant of the accepted forms. I am sorry for my ignorance, but I beg you will have the goodness, the very great goodness, to marry me."
As she did not reply, he added, "It would oblige me extremely, Diana."
"Why, Stephen,"
she said at last, still gazing at him with candid wonder,
"upon my word and honour, you astonish me. I can hardly speak. It was the kindest thing you could possibly have said to me. But your friendship, your affection is leading you away. It is your dear, good heart, full of pity for a friend that—"
"No, no, no," he cried passionately. "This is a deliberate, long-meditated statement, conceived a great while since, and matured over 12,000 miles and more. I am painfully aware," he said, clasping and unclasping his hands behind his back, "that my appearance does not serve me, that there are objections to my person, my birth, and my religion, and that my fortune is nothing in comparison with that of a wealthy man. But I am not the penniless nonentity I was when we first met. I can offer an honourable, if not a brilliant, marriage, and at the very lowest I can provide my wife, my widow, my relict,
with a décent compétence, an assured future.
Stephen, darling, you honour me beyond what I can express. You are the dearest man I know, by so very far my best friend. But you know I often speak like a fool when I am angry, fly out farther than I mean. I am an ill-tempered woman, I am afraid. I am deeply engaged to Canning. He has been extremely good to me. And what kind of a wife could I make for you? You should have married Sophie. She would have been content with very little, and you would never have been ashamed of her. Ashamed? Think what I have been. Think what I am now. And London is not far from Bombay. The gossip is the same in both. And having had this kind of life again, could I ever? Stephen, are you unwell?
I was going to say there is Barcelona, Paris, even Dublin.
You are certainly unwell. You look ghastly. Take off your coat. Sit in your shirt and breeches.
Sure, I have never felt the heat so much.
He threw off his coat and neckcloth.
Drink some iced water and put your head down. Dear Stephen, I wish I could make you happy. Pray do not look so wretched. Perhaps, you know, if it would come to a break.
And then again, he said, as though 10 silent minutes had not passed,
it is not a question of very little by European standards. I have about £10,000, I believe. An estate worth as much again, and capable of improvement. There is also my pay, he added, 200 or 300 a year.
And a castle in Spain, said Diana, smiling. Lie still and tell me about your castle in Spain. I know it has a marble bath.
Aye, and a marble roof, where it has a roof at all. But I must not practice on you, Villiers. It is not what you have here.
5 habitable rooms, and most of them are inhabited by merino sheep. It is a romantic ruin surrounded by romantic mountains. But romance does not keep the rain away.
He had made his attempt, delivered his charge, and it had failed. Now his heart beat quietly again. He was speaking in a companionable, detached voice about merino sheep, the peculiarities of a Spanish rent roll, the inconveniences of war, a sailor's chances of prize money, and he was reaching for his neckcloth when she interrupted him and said,
"Stephen, what you said to me turned my head about so much I hardly know what I answered. I must think. Let us talk about it again in Calcutta. I must have months and months to think. Lord, how pale you have gone again. Come, put on a light gown, and we will sit in the court for the fresh air. These lamps are intolerable indoors.
No, no, do not move.
Why? Because it is Canning's gown? Because he is my lover? Because he is a Jew?
Stuff! I have the greatest esteem for Jews, so far as anyone can speak of a heterogeneous great body of men in such a meaningless, illiberal way.
Canning walked into the room, a big man who moved lightly on his feet.
How long has he been outside? Thought Stephen, and Diana said, Canning, Dr. Maturin finds the heat a little much. I am trying to persuade him to put on a gown and to sit by the fountain in the Peacock Court. You remember Dr. Maturin?
Perfectly. And I'm very happy to see him. But, my dear sir, I am concerned that you should not be entirely well. It is indeed a most oppressive day. Pray give me your arm, and we will take the air. I could do with it myself. Diana, will you call for a gown, or perhaps a shawl?
How much does he know about me?
Wondered Stephen, as they sat there in the relative coolness, Canning and Diana talking quietly of his journey. The Nizam and a Mr. Norton. It seemed that Mr. Norton's best friend had run away into the Nizam's dominions with Mrs. Norton.
He gives nothing away, Stephen reflected, but that in itself is significant. And he has not asked after Jack, which is more so.
His bluff, manly air cannot be assumed, however. It is very like Jack's, and it certainly represents a great deal of the man. But I also perceive a gleam of hidden intelligence. How I wish he had Lady Forbes's gift of displaying his secret mind.
Mr. Norton, the ornithologist? He asked aloud.
No, said Diana. He is interested in birds.
So interested, said Canning, that he went off as far as Bikaner for a kind of sand grouse, and when he came back Mrs. Norton had flown. I do not think it a pretty thing to seduce a friend's wife.
I am sure you are right, said Stephen. But is it indeed a possible offence? A booby girl may be led away by a wicked fellow, to be sure, but a woman, a married woman. For my part, I do not believe that any marriage was ever yet broken by an outside force.
Let us suppose that Mrs. Norton is confronted with a choice between claret and port. She decides that she does not care for claret, but that she does care for port. From that moment she is wedded to her muddy brew, and it is impertinent to assure her that claret is her true delight. Nor does it seem to me that any great blame attaches to the bottle she prefers.
"If only there were a breath of air from the sea," said Canning with his deep belly laugh, "I should tear your analogy limb from limb. Besides, you would never have ventured upon it. A foul bottom, if ever there was one. But my point is that Norton was Morton's particular friend. Norton took him into his house, and he made his way into Norton's bed."
"That was not pretty, I must confess. It savours of impiety."
"I have not asked after our friend Aubrey," cried Canning. "Have you news of him? I believe we are to drink to his happiness. Perhaps we should even do so now."
"He is here, in Bombay. His frigate, the Surprise, is refitting in Bombay."
"You astonish me," said Canning.
"I doubt that very much, my friend," said Stephen inwardly. He listened to Canning's exclamations upon the service, its ubiquity, its wide commitments, Jack's excellence as a sailor, sincere and reiterated hopes for his happiness, and then he stood up, saying he believed he must beg permission to withdraw. It was some time since he had been to his lodgings, and work was waiting for him there. His lodgings were near the yard. He looked forward to the walk.
"You cannot walk all the way to the dockyard," said Canning. "I shall send for a palanquin."
"You are very good, but I prefer to walk."
"But, my dear sir, it is madness to stroll about Bombay at this time of night. You would certainly be knocked on the head. Believe me, it is a very dangerous city."
Stephen was not easily overcome, but Canning obliged him to accept an escort, and it was at the head of a train of bearded, sabre-bearing Sikhs that he paced through the deserted outer streets, not altogether pleased with himself.
"Yet I like the man, and do not entirely grudge him the satisfaction of knowing that I am off the scene, and that I do in fact live at such and such an address."
Down the hill, with the funeral pyres glowing on the shore, the scent of burning flesh and sandalwood, through quiet avenues tenanted by sleeping holy cows, pariah dogs, and one gaunt, leafless tree covered with roosting kites, vultures, crows, through the bazaars, filled now by shrouded figures lying on the ground. Through the brothel quarter by the port, life here, several competing musics, bands of wandering sailors, but not a surprise among them. Then the long, quiet stretch outside the wall of the yard, and as they turned a corner they fell upon a band of moplas, gathered in a ring. The moplas straightened, hesitated, gauging their strength, and then fled, leaving a body on the ground. Stephen bent over it, holding the Sikh's lantern. There was nothing he could do, and he walked on. From a distance he was surprised to see a light burning in their house, and he was more surprised, on walking in, to find Bondon there fast asleep. He was leaning over the table with his head on his bandaged arms, and both arms and head were covered with an ashy snow, the innumerable flying creatures that had been drawn to the lamp. A troop of geckos stood on the table to eat the dazzled moths.
"There you are at last, sir,"
he cried, starting up, scattering the geckos and his load of dead.
"I'm right glad to see you."
"It is kind in you to say so, Bondon," said Stephen. "What is up?"
"All hell is up, sir, pardon the expression. The captain is in a terrible taking over you, sir. Reefers and ship's boys relaying one another here. Messengers sent up every hour. Was you there yet? And afeard to go back and say no you wasn't, and no word either. Poor Mr. Babington in irons, and young Mr. Church and Callow flogged in the cabin with his own hands, and didn't he half lay it on, my eye? They howled as piteous as cats."
"Why, what's afoot?"
"What's afoot? Only blue murder, that's all. No liberty, all shore leave stopped. Barkey walked out into the basin, no bumboats allowed alongside for a drop of refreshment, and all hands at it, working double tides, officers too. No liberty at all, though promised weeks ago. You remember how the old Caesar got a new masts in by firelight in jib before our brush with the Spaniards? Well, it was like that, only day after day after bleeding day. Every hand that could hail on a rope, sick or not, gangs of Lascars, which he hired in personal, drafts from the flagship, riggers from the yard. It was like a fucking ant-heap, begging your pardon, and all in the flaming sun. No duff on Sunday, not a soul allowed on shore, bar shrimps that was no use aboard, and these here messengers at the double, which I should not be here myself but for my arm."
"What was it?"
"Boiling tar, sir, hot and hot off of the foretop, but nothing to what the captain's been ladling out. We reckon he must have word of Linois. But at any rate it has been drive, drive, drive. Not a dead eye turned in on Tuesday, and yet we rattled down the shrouds today, and we sail on tomorrow's tide.
Admiral did not believe it possible. I did not believe it possible, nor yet the oldest forecastleman. And like I said, or meant to say, Mr. Rattray took to his bed the Monday, wore out and sick, which half the rest of the people would have done the same if they dared. And all the time it was, "Where's the doctor? God damn you, sir, can't you find a doctor, you perishing swab?" Right vexed he was. Excellency's baggage aboard in double quick time, guns for the boats every 5 minutes, ball over their heads to encourage them to stretch out. God love us all. Here's a chit he gave me for you, sir.
Surprise, Bombay. Sir, you are hereby required and directed to report aboard HM ship under my command immediately upon receipt of this order. I am, etc., John Aubrey.
It is dated 3 days ago, observed Stephen.
Yes, sir. We've been handing it from one to the next by turns. Ned Hyde spilt some toddy on the corner.
Well, I shall read it tomorrow. I can hardly see tonight, and we shall get a couple of hours' sleep before sunrise. Does he indeed mean to sail upon the tide?
Lord, yes, sir. We must single anchor in the channel. Excellence is aboard, powder hoy alongside, and the last barrel stowing when I left her.
Dear me. Well, cut along to the ship now, Bondon. My compliments to the captain. I shall be with him before the full. Why do you stand there, Barrett Bondon, like a stock or image?
Sir, he'll call me a lubber and a fool, and I don't know what all if I come back without you. And I tell you straight, it will be a file of marines to carry you back to the ship the moment he knows you're here. I've followed him these many years, sir, and I've never known him so outrageous. Lions ain't in it.
Well, I shall be there before she sails. You need not hurry to the ship, you know, he said, pushing the unwilling, anxious, despondent Bondon out of the door and locking it behind him. Tomorrow would be the 17th. There might be other factors, but he was certain that one reason for this furious drive was Jack's desire to get him out of Bombay before Canning and Diana should return. No doubt he meant it kindly. No doubt he was afraid of an encounter between the two men. It was an ingenious piece of manipulation, but although Stephen was under naval law, he was not to be moved about quite so easily. He had never cared for laws at any time. He threw off his clothes, poured water over himself, and sat down to write a note to Diana. It would not do. He had hit the wrong tone. Another version, and the sweat running down his fingers blurred the words. Canning was a formidable enemy. Sharp, silent, quick. If indeed he was an enemy at all, the danger of overreaching oneself, Byzantine convolutions too cunning by half, the nausea of perpetual suspicion and intrigue, a hopeless nostalgia for a plain, direct relationship, for cleanliness. He reached for another sheet. It appeared that the enemy was at sea. He begged pardon for not taking leave, looked forward to a meeting in Calcutta, reminded her of the promised tiger, sent his compliments to Mr. Canning, and was sure he might confide his little protégé to her kindness. He was just about to purchase the child, for "That puts me in mind of my purse," he said. He found it, a small cloth bag, hung it round his neck, and put on a kind of shirt. Out into the cooler, cleaner air, through the streets again, more peopled now with the gardeners bringing in their fruit and vegetables, barrows, asses, bullocks, and camel carts making their way carefully through the grey darkness, pariah dogs flitting behind them. In the bazaars there were small lamps everywhere, and the glow of braziers, a general stirring, people picking up their beds and carrying them indoors, or turning them into stalls. On through the Garhwal caravanserai, past the Franciscan church, past the Jain temple, to the alley where Dil lived. The alley was unusually crowded. Already there were people filling in from side to side, and it was only by urging a Brahmin bull in front of him that he was able to reach the triangular booth made of planks and wedged against a buttress. The old woman was sitting in front of it, with a wavering lamp on her right side, a white-robed man on the other, Dil's body in front of her, partly covered with a piece of cloth. On the ground, a bowl with some marigolds in it, and four brass coins. The people pressed in a half-circle facing her, listening gravely to her harsh, angry voice. He sat down in the second rank, went down with a grunt as though his legs had been cut from under him, and he felt an intolerable pain rising in his heart. He had seen so much death that he could not be mistaken. But after some time the hard acceptance he had learnt cleared his mind at least. The old woman was calling upon the crowd for money, breaking off to tell the Brahmin that a very little would do, wrangling with him, insisting. The people were kind, many words of comfort, sympathy and praise, small offerings added to the bowl. But it was a desperately poor neighbourhood, and the coins did not amount to half a dozen logs.
"Here is no one of her caste," said the man next to Stephen, and other people murmured that that was the cruel pity of the thing. Her own people would have seen to the fire. But with a famine coming, no man dared look beyond the caste he belonged to.
"I am of her caste," said Stephen to the man in front of him, touching his shoulder. "Tell the woman I will buy the child. Friend, tell the woman I will buy the child and take it down. I will attend to the fire."
The man looked round at him. Stephen's eyes were remote, his cheeks hollow, lined, and dirty, his hair straggled over his face. He might well have been mad, or in another state, removed. The man glanced at his grave neighbours, felt their qualified approval, and called out,
"Grandmother, here is a holy man of thy caste, who from piety will buy the child and take it down. He will also provide the wood."
More conversation, cries, and a dead silence. Stephen felt the man thrust the purse back into his bosom, patting and arranging his shirt round the string. After a moment he stood up. Dill's face was infinitely calm. The wavering flame made it seem to smile mysteriously at times, but the steady light showed a face as far from emotion as the sea, contained and utterly detached. Her arms showed the marks where the bracelets had been torn off, but the marks were slight. There had been no struggle, no desperate resistance. He picked her up, and followed by the old woman, a few friends, and the Brahmin, he carried her to the strand, her head lolling against his shoulder. The dawn broke as they went down through the bazaar. Three parties were already there before them, at the edge of the calm sea, beyond the wood cellars. Prayers, lustration, chanting, lustration. He laid her on the pyre, pale flames in the sunlight, the fierce rush of blazing sandalwood, and the column of smoke rising, rising, inclining gently away as the breeze from the sea set in.
"Nunc et in horror mortis nostri," he repeated yet again,
and felt the lap of water on his foot. He looked up. The people had gone. The pyre was no more than a dark patch with the sea hissing in its embers, and he was alone. The tide was rising fast.